Disc 5.
There, you see, cries he, springing a foot. Our royal host is doing the local chamois a piece of no good. How do you know it's him? It might be anyone. It might be the Aston Villa Brake Club picnic, but I doubt it. In the Emperor's personal woods? He swung up his rucksack and plunged into the trees. Come on. We pushed rapidly uphill into the woods, down into a little hollow, and up again over a steep, stony place. And now there came two shots in quick succession, much closer, and off to our left. Wait here, says Willem, and was off into the undergrowth at a run. I breathed myself against a tree, debating whether to rush blindly downhill away from this fatal nonsense. Remembered Hutton and the Queen, and stood there sweating and gnashing my teeth. And here he was again, face alight with unholy joy, slithering towards me over the fallen leaves and needles.
Eureka! He's there, large as life, having a smoke while his loader measures the horns of some dead beast, which I suppose he's shot. Couldn't be better.
He caught me by the shoulder. Now's the hour, Harry, my boy. This is where you rip your ankle, and I holler for help. Ready?
You're raving mad, says I through chattering teeth. You and Bismarck both. Oh, Christ!
For the swine had fetched me a sudden shattering kick above the ankle, and I went down in agony, fairly writhing on the leaves as I clutched my injured limb and damned him to hell and beyond. It was as though I'd been shot, and he stepped over me, measured his distance, and kicked me savagely again in almost the same place.
If you've hurt yourself, the medico's got to have something to look at, you know, grins he. Not so loud, you asshole, they'll think you're dying. Groan, and try to look gallantly long-suffering.
I was too dizzy with pain to do anything but curse and weep, and now he was away again, yelling,
Helpful, mein Herr,
while I tried to pull myself up by a tree, wrenching at my gaiter buttons and sock, to reveal an ankle that was grazed bloody and already turning blue. God, had he broken it? I nursed the injury with both hands, feeling it beginning to puff and swell, and now footsteps were approaching. Willem's voice raised in concern.
Caught his leg between two stones, I think. I don't believe it's broken, but too badly wrenched to walk, I fear. On the first day of our expedition, too.
You say your friend is an Englishman?
It was a deep voice, curiously flat and deliberate.
Why, yes, an army acquaintance. Neither of us has been to the Salzkammergut before, you see, and we planned... Ah, here he is. How is it, Harry? I say, it looks bad.
He turned to his companion.
By the way, I'm Count Willem von Starnberg. Herr...
He finished on a question, the cunning young bastard, letting on that he didn't know whom he was addressing, and I gritted my teeth and tried to act up, noting as I did so that it was a good job there were no Highland regiments in the Austrian service, for the Emperor Franz Joseph would have looked abominable in a kilt, with those knobbly knock-knees looking like knuckle-ends between his woollen stockings and his little black lederhosen. He wore a shooting jacket and a ridiculous hat with a feather, but there was nothing clownish about the austere, frowning face with its heavy whiskers, as he stooped to survey my damage. Nothing sympathetic either, just bovine serious.
It needs attention, was the royal diagnosis. Can you vox up?
There must be an actor buried in me, for as Willem bent to help me, and I met Franz Joseph's heavy stare, I fairly gaped, wide-eyed, and made as though to scramble up.
My God, I croaked. Your Majesty, I babble,
while Willem looked suitably startled and clicked his heels, and Franz Joseph made another of his lightning deductions.
You know me?
Didn't I just, though begging his pardon, introducing myself with profuse apologies for coming adrift in his covers, doffing my tile, while Willem did likewise, bowing like a clockwork doll, while Franz Joseph registered amazement by blinking thoughtfully.
"Sir Officer of Mexico," says he, "you are he who attempted to save my unhappy brother. I invested you with the Order of Maria Theresa at Corfu, was it not?"
After that, it was old home week, with a vengeance, with Franz Joseph nodding gravely, Willem protesting that we were a hellish nuisance, all highest, and wouldn't have dreamed of intruding if we'd only known. Flashy, clinging gamely to his tree, and presently even more gamely to the stalwart back of the loader, who was summoned to tote me downhill. I lay there, breathing in his aroma of rifle oil and cow dung, wondering what the harvest might be. And Willem walked ahead with Franz Joseph, making deferential noises of gratitude and apology, and to my astonishment making his majesty laugh. Say that for the Starnbergs. They could charm birds from the trees when they wanted to. And by the time we reached the lodge, the Emperor of Austria was positively jocose, issuing orders to fly in minions, and not going off to change his ghastly breeks until he'd seen me installed on a couch in a gunroom, with servitors rallying round with hot water and cold compresses, and Willem chivying them aside while he attended to my bandages himself.
"We're there," he murmured softly. "He knows my family, by name, anyway."
I could have said that if he'd known any more of the Starnbergs than that, we'd have been on our way to jail this minute, but held my peace.
"Play up when the doctor comes, mind?"
Which I did, with Willem and Franz Joseph, now respectable in a suit, standing by. The Sawbones was a plump little cove with gooseberry eyes and trailing whiskers, who prodded my injury and pronounced it ugly, but seemed to think I ought to be able to hobble. "Capital," thinks I. "There'll be no reason to offer us house room, and we can scuttle back to Ischl and let the Holnup have a free run." But Willem had the answer to that. Rot him.
"Your thigh wound, remember?" says he, very sober. "A serious injury from my friend's Afghan days," he assured the doctor, "which reacts to any distemper in the limb. Why, Harry, you were laid up for a week in Scotland, I recall, when you've done no more than stub your toe."
Observe the guile of it. He knew that if anything appealed to Franz Joseph, it was an honourable scar. He was soldier daft, and had himself risked life and limb with extraordinary stupidity during his various campaigns, all of which he'd lost, by the way. So now you find Flashy lying trouserless, while the doctor goggled at the impressive scar on my thigh, and the knee wound I'd taken at Harper's Ferry, and even the hole in my buttock where the slave catchers shot me while crossing the frozen Ohio, with Willem murmuring to an impressed Franz Joseph that this wasn't the half of it. You ought to see the rest of the bugger's carcass. Not an inch of it whole, I assure your majesty. Hell of a life the boy's led, honestly. Or words to that effect. The Emperor shook his head in respectful wonder, and the linseed lancer, taking his cue, muttered about secondary reaction and delayed muscular lesions. It might well be, he opined, that even a minor contusion might render a limb temporarily incapable. At which Willem played his masterstroke.
"Well, old fellow, I can see we'll just have to carry you down to Ischl. Is the thigh very painful? Never mind, I'll whistle up a chair or something, and a few handy chaps. If your majesty," says he with another bow and heel click, "will be gracious enough to allow my friend to rest here while I make arrangements. No more than an hour. Profound apologies. Great imposition. There, old chap. Just bite on something."
It would have had Scrooge pipe in his eye. Franz Joseph glowered at the doctor and said it would be unwise to move me, surely, and the poultice walloper agreed that it would be nothing short of bloody reckless. "Richtig," announced Franz Joseph. "Then the gentleman stays here, at least until he can walk without difficulty, so fall in the loyal attendants." Willem's protests were pretty to hear, but Franz Joseph wouldn't even listen. Unthinkable that I should be moved in my present state. It would be a privilege to entertain so gallant an officer, to whom his majesty was already indebted for services to the royal family. Count Starnberg must remain also. If my injury permitted, we would give the emperor the pleasure of our company at dinner. In the meantime, affairs required his attendance elsewhere. By this time I was beginning to wonder if I'd ever walk again, and it was with some relief that I discovered, after I'd been borne upstairs between two servants and left in a comfortable chamber overlooking the garden, that I could move without the least difficulty, and was none the worse, except for an uncomfortable bruise. Willem suggested that I should recover sufficiently to hobble by dinner time. "We're going to be afoot tonight," says he. "And it wouldn't do for you to be encountered walking if you were meant to be bed-bound, you poor old cripple. You—" He was in a bouncy fettle, inviting me to admire the way everything had gone exactly according to plan, pacing up and down with his cigarette holder at a jaunty angle. "A heavy limp, I think, with the aid of a stick. Too late for F.J. to turn us out of doors now. What?" I asked how on earth he'd known so much about my wounds, and received his superior grin. "You can't get it into your head, can you?
Bismarck has a genius for detail. Why, I know as much about your battle scars as you do. He reached suddenly to tousle my hair, curse him. Got yourself scalped by Indians in the Wild and Woolly West, even. Oh, yes, says the insolent pup. I've seen a dossier on you that I'll bet contains things you've forgotten, perhaps never knew. You've been about, though. My stars, I hope I'll see half as much by the end of the day. He shook his handsome head, and the admiring look of our first meeting was back again. The governor was right. You're the complete hand, and no mistake. On that train, there you were, wondering what the deuce you'd fallen into. Ensnared by a sinister adventuress, menaced by a bravo with a pistol. But did you cry havoc, or bluster, or vow to have the law on us? Well, once. And then, mama's an oyster, figuring chances, listening and biding your time. I didn't trust you at an inch. Then, Kralta did, though, and she's no fool, even she is spoony about you. But it took that business of Gunther getting scragged at the casino to convince me. Then I knew you must be with us. He grinned, tongue in cheek. And it ain't for Franz Joseph or the good of the peace, is it? It's just for devilment. He slapped his knee, merry as a maggot. I like you, Harry, shot if I don't, and we'll have some fun together. Just you wait and see. He sprang up and tossed his cigarette into the fireplace. Now then, I'm going to take a scout about, get the lie of the land, and find out who does what, and goes where, and when, and why. Rob an acquaintance with the aides, if I can, and take a professional interest in this sergeant and his file of sentinels. This with a knowing wink. You lie, and rest your mangled pin, and when I come back we can discuss ways and means, eh? He chewed his lip and tapped another gasper on his thumbnail, looking keen. Do you know, I've a notion tonight is going to be the night. Can't tell why, just an instinct. You ever feel that sort of thing?
When I was young and green, yes, growls I, to take the bounce out of him. Sign of nerve, Starnberg. You just wish it was over and done with.
It didn't deflate him a bit. Nerves yourself, scoffs he. If you mean I'm looking forward to it, you're right.
I believed him, for I'd seen the same bright-eyed excitement at the prospect of slaughtering idiots like Brooke and Custer, and it's the last thing you need when your own fears are gullet high.
That reminds me, he went on. Time you were properly dressed.
He drew the laveau from his pocket, spun it deftly, and presented the butt.
5 chambers loaded. I'll give you the other rounds later. Shove it out of sight for the moment.
Being armed was some comfort, but not much. Like his blasted instinct, it was just a reminder of how close the doom was coming. Perhaps only a few short hours away. In the meantime, left to myself, I could only wait, fretting and resting my bogus injury on the sofa, while soft-footed orderlies came and clicked their heels and asked leave to arrange the room and see to the linen and mend the fire and stow away my effects, which must have been sent for to the Golden Ship, trust Willem, and bring me coffee, which I shared with 2 sprightly youths who were Franz Joseph's aides, come to pay their respects to the wounded guest. I forget their names, but thought of them as Tweedledum and Tweedledee, 1 fair, 1 dark, but identical in gaiety, in discretion, and breezy but deferential attention to me. Tweedledee knew of me by name and fame, and was athirst for reminiscences. But since Tweedledum's interest was merely polite, and I'm an old hand at not being pumped, it was child's play to steer the conversation elsewhere. Thus I learned in short order that Ischl was a confounded bore, and that it was common gossip that the Emperor was only here because he'd hoped to achieve a reconciliation with Sissy, who was in one of her fits of avoiding Vienna, but had half agreed to come to Ischl, only she hadn't, more's the pity. For squiring her on horseback would have been a welcome diversion. Never mind, they'd be back in Vienna on Sunday, thank God, and free of the tyranny of the chief equerry, who was a muff and a sneak, and of the ordeal of dining with the Emperor, and being used as errand boys by his secretary, and why the old boy had to spend all day poring over papers when he was meant to be on holiday. Beat them altogether. Kept him out of the way, of course, even at luncheon, which was a mercy, since his usual fare was boiled beef and beer at his desk. At least they were spared that. Here, though, my chum Starnberg was a splendid fellow, wasn't he? Just the chap to liven up a slow week, and so on, and so on. It would be a dull world if there were no subalterns in it. Quieter, mind you. They went at last, with noisy jests and good wishes, and I was left to brood, until an orderly brought luncheon on a tray. Not boiled beef, as I recall, but I was too blue and shaky to make much of whatever it was. I had barely finished when Willem returned, making a great show of closing the door silently, tiptoeing to sit on my sofa, and speaking in a whisper.
"It's too good to be true. Harry, my boy, I can't believe our luck. Why, it'll be child's play."
He rubbed his hands, chuckling.
"I found the outer door to the Emperor's secret stairway. I'm almost certain. How's that for intelligence work?"
He lighted one of his eternal black cigarettes and puffed in triumph.
"I bumped into the sergeant of the guard, accidental a purpose, a waxed moustache old turnip head, who's so damn military he probably rides his wife by numbers. Almost ruptured himself coming to attention when I happened by. I played the condescending Junker, commended his turnout, complimented him on being chosen for such important duty."
He waved his holder airily.
"You know the style. The old fool was so flattered he confessed the job was mostly ceremonial. Mind in the front door, saluting the Emperor, and so on." "But you mount night sentry, surely," says I. "One only, Herr Oberst," says he. "Ah, patrolling, to be sure," says I. "By no means, Herr Oberst, a fixed post at the sundial corner only." "Why, there, can't tell the time at night," says I. Gad, I was genial. Harry, he didn't know why, said it was regulations since God was a boy.
He was so full of himself he couldn't be still, jumping up and pacing to and fro.
That was enough for me. I chatted a moment more, as is my wont, and strolled round by the sundial corner, as he called it. Sentry box, sure enough, and a few yards further on, an embrasure in the ivy with an old locked door. The window of the Emperor's bedchamber is about 20 feet beyond, on the story above. "Well," cries he, "what do you think of that for scouting?"
"Too good to be true, indeed. Yet why not? It fitted, if the secret stairway really existed, and I had respect enough for Bismarck's spy Bandobast to be confident that it did." Bandobast is an organization in Hindi.
"So now," cries Willem, "we know just where to watch."
"Well, if it is the secret door, and they come that way."
"It is, and they will," says he impatiently. "I'm sure of it. But we'll run no risks."
He pulled a chair beside the sofa and sat close.
"I thought it all out, and I'm afraid," says he with a mock rueful grin, "that you mayn't like it, because you'll miss most of the sport. Sorry, old chap."
From that moment, you may be sure I was all ears.
"It's this way. My room's next door here, but we're some way from the Emperor's quarters. Our corridor leads to the main part of the house, which is like so many of these royal places, one room opening onto another, and then another, and so on. But then there's another passage to the Emperor's rooms, an ante-room where his orderly sleeps, and then the royal bedchamber overlooking the sundial garden. There's a room off the passage for the aides. Ah, you've met them. Couple of society buffoons. So that's the lie of the land."
He paused to light another whiff.
"You see the point. There are only two ways to come at Franz Joseph, either by the secret stair, or along the passage leading past the aide's room to his quarters. Plug those, and he's secure. Now," says he, leaning close, "I'll lay odds the Holner will come through the garden in the dead watch, round four, lay out the sentry quietly, jemmy the door, then upstairs, and good night, Franz Josef, all hail Crown Prince Rudolf. But, just in case they enter the house some other way, one of us will lurk by the passage, while t'other is in the garden covering the secret doorway. You follow?"
I followed, and relief was surging through me like the wave of the sea as he went on.
"You at the passage, et moi in the garden. No, shut up, Harry. It must be so, because once the smoke is cleared and the Holnopper laid stiff and stark, I can say I couldn't sleep and was just taking a stroll and ran into her, see? That wouldn't answer for you with your game leg. Whereas, if you're watching the passage inside and someone happens along, you can always say you were looking for the thunder closet."
"That means," says I, frowning, "that you'll tackle them alone, one against perhaps three, perhaps more."
"No more than three, if so many," says he, baring his teeth. "Never fear, Harry, they're dead men."
His hands moved like lightning, and there was the Webley in one fist and the Derringer in t'other.
"With all respect, old fellow, I doubt if you're as quick with a piece as I, or as good a shot."
"Don't know about that," says I,
looking glum while repressing an urge to sing Hallelujah. "How many night ambushes have you laid?"
"Enough," says he jauntily. "Cheer up. Perhaps they'll come through the house after all."
"And afterwards, how do you explain that you went for a night stroll with a gun in your pocket?"
"I didn't. Discovering miscreants trying to break in with evil intent, I gamely tackled them, disarmed one, and Bob's your uncle, as they say."
"I still don't like it." "I lied. We'd be better with two in the garden."
"No," says he flatly. "One must be in the house, you. When you hear a shot, make for your room and then emerge, hobbling and roaring for enlightenment."
"When I hear a shot, I'll be out of doors before you know it. You may be good, Starnberg, but I've forgotten more about night fighting than you'll ever know. And that, my son, is that."
It's always been second nature with me to act sullen, reluctant, when I've been denied the prospect of battle and murder. Suits my character, you see. In the event that he had to tackle Alnop alone, the last thing I'd dream of doing would be to hasten to his aid. Back to bed and snug down, deaf as a post. That'd be the ticket for Flashy, and he could have the glory to himself. Which I realized was what he'd intended all along. I'd been necessary for gaining admittance, and all the rest had been so much gas. Well, good luck, Willem, and I hope you kill a lot of Hungarians. In the meantime, I looked sour, vowing to be in at the death, and he laughed and said, "Well, so be it. My presence in the garden with my game leg might seem odd, but with the Emperor preserved, no one would think twice about it, likely." Then he took a big breath and sat back, delighted with himself and his planning, and fell to admiring Bismarck's uncanny genius, and I was all falling out precisely as he'd forecast. But mostly he was nursing his bloodlust, I knew, anticipating the pleasure of shooting assassins. In the back, no doubt. He was what Hickok called a killing gentleman, was our Willem. Just like dear old Dad. Dinner at 5 with Franz Joseph would have been a damn dreary business, no doubt, if I hadn't been so full of inward rejoicing at my reprieve, and consequently at peace with all mankind. I made my appearance limping on a stick, and His Majesty combined his congratulations with a dour warning against overexertion. He was one of these unfortunates who have been created stuffy by God, and whose efforts to unbend create discomfort and unease in all concern. Chiefly himself. It reminded me of a pompous master condescending to the fags. Even when he had the words, he couldn't get the tune at all. For example, when he informed me over the soup that he had only poor command of English, he managed to convey that the fault lay not only with his boyhood tutors, but with me for speaking the damn language in the first place. Even his compliment to my German sounded like a reproach. I responded with a wheeze I'd once heard, from Bismarck, as it happens, that a gift for languages was useful only to head waiters, and Willem played up by saying he'd been told that it was a sign of low intelligence. Franz Joseph rolled a bread pill gloomily and said that wasn't what his tutors had told him, and he had no experience of head waiters. After this flying start, we ate in silence until Franz Joseph began to question me solemnly about Indian Army camp discipline and sanitary arrangements, with particular reference to care of the feet in hot climates. I did my best, and like a fool, ventured Wellington's joke when the Queen asked him what was the aroma from the ranks of the guards, and Nosey replied, "Esprit de corps, ma'am." That was met with a vacant stare, so I guessed he didn't speak French too well either. The only topics that seemed to ring into life were horses and game shooting. He knew his business about the former, and was, I'm told, an expert rider. As for the latter, about which he prosed interminably, I can only say that my abiding memory of Ischel Lodge is of rank upon rank of chamois horns covering the walls from floor to ceiling. Wherever you went, all shot by the royal sportsmen. There must have been thousands of them. After dinner, the real merriment began when we played a game of tarock, a sort of whist, and I can testify that to his linguistic shortcomings, the Austrian emperor added an inability to count, and pondered each card at length before playing. I guess the fun was too much for him, for after a couple of rubbers he went back to work at his desk, and we were free to return to our rooms and wait. I can't recall many nights longer than that one, even though I'd been excused active service, so to speak, assuming the enemy didn't come through the house.
I was like a cat on hot bricks, and Willem was no better. We played every two-handed game we knew in my room, and he was too edgy to cheat, even. About 8 o'clock, an orderly brought us tea, when what I needed was brandy. About a pint and a half, and we learned that the Emperor was used to retire to bed about 9, and the establishment closed down accordingly. Sure enough, we heard the tramp of the sergeant and sentry beneath the window, marching round the house, and distant words of command as the sentry was posted. "Damned old martinet!" mutters Willem, as we heard the heavy tread of the sergeant's return, fading as he went round to the guard-house at the front. "Imagine barking orders as if it were a parade. I suppose it's for Franz Josef's benefit, as he says his prayers. The sentry is relieved every 3 hours, by the way, and you may be sure the Holnup know that. So between 3 and 6 will be their best time. We'll be on the watch from 10, though. They'd hardly come before that." We were standing at the window as he spoke, looking out into the darkened garden, palely lit by the moon in its last quarter, the bushes casting shadows on the turf, and the dark mass of the trees against the night sky, with the wind barely ruffling their leaves. Beneath us, there was the sound of a lower window being shuttered, a door banged, and we could hear the smack of the bolts thrust home. From somewhere within the house, a distant clock sounded the half hour, and then the only noise was the faint occasional creak of the house itself, as it settled for another peaceful night. I was aware of a faint tapping, and was well pleased to note that it was Willem's fingers playing on the sill. But the handsome face was serene enough now, and when he caught my glance at his restless hand, he laughed softly. "Waiting for the kick-off, eh?" says he. "Or going out to open the batting? You played it all? If your dossier on me was complete, you know I took 5 for 12 against all England," says I. And he whistled, but when I added that I once downed Felix, Pilch, and Min in 3 balls, the ignorant brute had never heard of them. "See Flashman's lady. For my time," says he. "Grace, now there's a bat for you." So we talked cricket while waiting for the attempted murder of the Austrian Emperor. Well, I've known odder conversations on the brink of desperate action. When the distant chime of 10 sounded, he slipped away and returned in his night-stalking attire, dark shirt and trousers with a heavy woolen jersey, light hunting boots, and flask and pistol all stowed away. There was a wicked-looking hunting knife sheathed at his belt. "You never know what you need until you need it," says he. "Don't fret, I'll be rid of it before any investigation begins." He patted the hilt, and it struck me yet again, watching his quick, deft movements, the easy way he held himself, the bright, questing eyes, and the confident half-smile on the chiselled face, that there were plenty of fellows I'd rather meet in a dark lane than Willem von Starnberg. He was on a hair trigger, and enjoying every moment of it. "Got your piece?" says he. "Good. I've had a look-see, and the place is like a tomb. What price Ischel for high jinks, eh? I'd rather have Stockholm on a Sunday. Now, I'll take you along to your post, which is in the last of the day-rooms from which the passage runs to the Emperor's billet and the aide's quarters. There's a nice shadowy corner where you can watch the passage entry, and on t'other side of the room there's a flight of stairs leading down to a little hall, where I'll get out by a window." He paused, thinking. "If they come tonight, as I feel they will, you'd best use your judgment when the shooting starts. A few quick shots will mean it's all over. If there's still firing after 20 seconds, well, 'twill mean there are more of them than I bargained for. If they don't come, back to bed with you when the house begins to stir. I'll be out, taking the morning air," he added with a wink. "All clear, then? All serene, oh?" It wasn't, of course, but I gave him my resolute chin-up look and got his approving nod. "Best take your stick, in case anyone comes on you unexpected in the small hours. Though I doubt if there'll be a soul about before dawn. Unless," says he, looking comical, "the Holnup diddle us by coming through the house. In which case, well, good hunting, you lucky bastard." He moved quickly to the door, peeped out, and slipped into the corridor, motioning me to follow. There was a light burning at the far end, but not a sound in the building, save the occasional creak of its timbers. Willem fluttered ahead like a ghost, and what we'd have said if someone had popped a head out and found us roaming the darkened house, God knows. We crossed what he'd called the day-rooms, one after another. They had lamps burning low, and here and there the waning moon struck a shaft of light through a window, and the embers of a fire glowed in the shadows. At last he paused, flicking a finger to his left, and I saw a flight of stairs leading down into the blackness. He pointed to his right, and there was the dark opening of the passage leading to Franz Joseph's room. A lamp gleamed dimly on a table at the passage entry, and now Willem pointed to a shadowy corner to the left of the passage, and a few feet from it, where I could see a big leather chair. At his nod, I moved quietly towards it. Then he blew out the passage light, leaving the room in darkness. I didn't hear him move, but suddenly I sensed him beside me, his hand gripping mine, and his voice close to my ear. "Good luck, Holden," and then a whispered chuckle. "Ain't this the life, though?" Infernal idiot. A second later, his shadow was at the head of the stairs, and soon after I heard below the faint noise of a sash being raised and closed again. And good riddance. And then, well, you know, there was nothing to do but sit about, a prey to what they call conflicting emotions. I'd run a fair range of them in the past few days, some damn disturbing, a few delightful with Kralter, but mostly bewildering. And now, seated in that great leather contraption, I tried to take stock of what was, you'll allow, an unusual situation. Here was I, in the summer residence of the Emperor of Austria, loaded for bear, waiting for bloody murder to break out in his policies. But the odd thing was that now that the grip had come, I wasn't more than half nervous, let alone scared. I was as well out of harm's way as any man in the place. Willem could bear the brunt, and the aftermath of everyone behaving like headless chickens should provide some entertainment. He'd be the hero of the hour, if he lived. But I'd garner some credit if only by limping about looking stern and impressing the excitable kraut-eaters with my British phlegm. A little discreet lie-in when I saw Hutton again would ensure that favourable reports reached London and Paris. And Windsor, eh? And after an amiable parting from Franz Joseph, it would be hey for Vienna with a grateful and adoring Kralter. She was a happy thought, as I sat cosily ensconced in the dark, still warm from the dead fireplace. Odd female, handsome enough in her horsey way, with a body of a Dahomey Amazon and appetite to match. But would she have boiled my kettle in the ordinary way of things? Perhaps it was the strange circumstances in which we'd met, or the contrast between her icy, damn you style and the passion with which she performed that had me drying my chin at my randy recollections. That fur robe slipping to the floor, like the unveiling of a lovely marble statue, the long limbs entwining with mine, the silky hair across my face. Aye, Vienna beckoned, right enough, and on those blissful imaginings I settled comfortably to my vigil in the hours ahead. To awake with a start, shivering against the cold that had stolen over the darkened room while I slept. For how long? The soft, single chime of a clock might mean 1 o'clock, or a quarter, but I had no feeling of cramp, so I couldn't have been far under. But what had wakened me? The clock, or the cold, or some other disturbance, and suddenly my hair bristled on my neck, as I became aware of a faint scraping sound from the hall below, followed by a rustle and a soft thump. Jesus, there was someone moving there. And the scrape had been the raising of the window by which Willem had departed. Could he be returning? No. Why the hell should he? But who, then? And I froze in terror, the sweat breaking out on me like ice, for it could mean only one thing, that the stupid swine's calculations had been all wrong, and the Holmes had never heard of his confounded secret stair, but were slipping into the house burglar-style, intent on their murderous errand. And even now, cloaked in sinister figures were at the foot of the stairs, listening, then gliding stealthily forward. A stair creaked sharply, and I started half out of my chair, fumbling for the laveau, straining eyes and ears against the dark. Another creak, and a hissing whisper. Someone stumbled and cursed, and then, to my amazement, a voice began croaking softly in drunken song about Liebe kleine Mathilde, only to be hushed by a snarled oath and, "Wo ist die Kerze? Streichholz, Dummkopf!" followed by a giggling hiccup. A match rasped in the gloom. A faint glow appeared below. And I almost collapsed with relief, as slowly up the stairs lurched Tweedledum, holding a candle unsteadily aloft, with Tweedledee clinging to him for support. They were in dress uniform, and by the look of them had crawled through every pub initial. A I've seldom seen tighter subalterns. But Tweedledum at least was plainly alive to the danger of waking the Emperor, for he staggered with elaborate caution, whispering to his mate to be quiet. I must have seen me in my corner if Tweedledee hadn't blown the candle out in an enormous belch. This set him giggling again. Tweedledum dropped the matches. They blundered, whimpering in the dark, and would most certainly have come to grief if Tweedledum hadn't insisted that they proceed on hands and knees. They crawled through the furniture more or less quietly, and presently I heard their door close softly, and peace returned to the royal lodge. But not to me. Perhaps it was the cold, or the unholy scare they'd given me, but as I sat shivering in the dark, envying those drunken pups their beds, I was conscious of a growing unease, which was quite at odds with the lustful moonings about Crowther, on which I'd dropped off. I couldn't figure it. Nothing about my situation had changed, and yet where I'd been fairly tranquil before, I was now thoroughly rattled. Very well, I'm a windy bugger whose hopes and fears go up and down like a jack-in-the-box, but this wasn't so much fear as a presentiment that something was wrong, damned wrong, and I couldn't put my finger on it. It wasn't a logical foreboding, but pure animal instinct, and thank God for it, because it made me stir restlessly, and my fidgeting changed the course of history. At the recent alarm, I'd clutched at the lever in my pocket, and at some point must have drawn it, for now I found I was nervously fiddling its patent safety catch, on and off, and turning the cylinder. That reminded me, with a nasty start, that Willem hadn't given me the promised extra rounds. He'd said it was loaded in 5 chambers, and in sudden anxiety I probed with my pinky in the dark, trying to feel the tips of the slugs in the cylinders, but couldn't, so I broke the piece open, not knowing that it was one of the newfangled models, with an extractor plate that whips all the shells out together, and squealed with dismay as bullets flew broadcast, clattering on the floor and rolling God alone knew where. And there I was, with an unloaded firearm, my ammunition hopelessly lost in the dark, and nothing for it but to grovel blindly in search of the bloody things, cursing fate and the imbecility of French gunsmiths and their ridiculous patent gadgets, as if anyone needed them. Frantic scrabbling round the chair brought one bullet to hand, leaving 4 to find. And since I had no intention of having only a single shot between me and damnation, I must have light, whatever the consequences. I had no matches, but stay, Tweedledum had dropped his somewhere. I'd heard them spilling all over the shop. So now I went panting on all 4s in quest of them, lost my bearings altogether, fell into the fireplace, struggled out, coated in dead ash, fetched my head a shattering crash on a chair leg, and only found the scattered matches when I knelt on them. In a trice, I had one lighted, and was kindling the lamp, and a moment later I'd scooped up 3 of the fallen rounds near the chair and was casting about for the 4th. It was lying close to the fender, at least the case was, but I drew in an astonished breath when I saw that the bullet itself had become detached and lay a few inches away. In 50 years of handling firearms, I'd never known the like. What, a slug, clamped tight in the brass case, which contained the explosive charge, coming asunder? With a trembling hand I turned the little case to the light. It was empty, and there wasn't a trace of powder where it had fallen. An icy hand gripped my stomach as I held each of the other whole rounds in turn close to the lamp. Every one bore marks on the edge of the case, as though it had been pried back to remove the slug. Indeed, I was able to pull one bullet free and saw to my horror that the case itself was empty. Willem had removed the charges from all 5 cartridges, replacing the slugs in them so that they looked like live rounds, and if one hadn't come loose and fallen to the floor, I'd never known that I had, in fact, an empty revolver. Chapter 8. The discovery that you've been sold a pup is always disconcerting, but your reaction depends on age and experience. In infancy, you burst into tears and smash something. In adolescence, you may be bewildered, as I was when Lady Geraldine lured me into the long grass on false pretense and then set about me with carnal intent. Hurrah! In riper manhood, common sense usually tells you to bolt, which is my instinct on the Pearl River when I learned that my locker was carrying not opium, as I'd supposed, but guns for the Taiping rebels. But at 61, your brain works faster than your legs, so you reflect, and as often as not, reach the right answer by intuition as well as reason. Kneeling in that cold, shadowy chamber, goggling at those five useless rounds gleaming in the dim lamplight, I knew, in a split second, that Willem himself was the assassin, not the guardian. And now that I'd served my turn by helping him to within striking distance of the Emperor, he'd rendered me powerless to intervene in his murderous scheme. But it was a staggering thought. Damn it, why should he, a German Junker, a trusted agent of Bismarck, want to kill Franz Joseph, doing the dirty work of Hungarian fanatics like Kossuth and the Holnup? Kossuth, by God! That was the bell that rang to confirm my conclusion, as I remembered him telling me on the train that his own mother's name was Kossuth, and that he was part Hungarian by blood. Aye, and pure Hungarian, devil a doubt, in heart and soul and allegiance, flown with the wild dream of independence for his mother country, and itching to fire the shot or wield the steel that would set her free, and plunge Europe into civil war. All this surmised in an instant, and whether 'tis all another great devilment of Bismarck's, or whether Bismarck was guiltless, and Willem had duped him as he duped me, didn't matter. One thing was sure, I was implicated up to the neck, and as I knelt there sweating, my imagination was picturing Willem out yonder, full of spite and sin, disposing of the hapless sentry, humouring the lock of the secret door, stealing up the secret stair, knife in hand, to the room where his royal victim was asleep. Or, dead already? I glanced in terror towards the passage entry. Quick or dead, Franz Joseph was within 40 feet of me. Oh, Christ, how long had Willem been gone? I didn't know. Was it too late to stop him? Perhaps not. But that was no work for me, begod. Not if I had 10 loaded pistols and the Royal Marines at my back. Not for Franz Joseph and a dozen like him would I have gone up against Willem von Starnberg. And as for Europe... But even as I took the first instinctive stride of panic-stricken flight, I came to a shuddering halt as the awful truth struck me. I couldn't run. It would be certain death, for if Willem had killed, or was about to kill, the Emperor, I'd be seen as his partner in crime. And while he would have his own escape nicely planned, I'd not have the ghost of a chance of avoiding capture, with the whole country on the lookout. And I'd never persuade them I was an innocent tool, or acting under orders from Downing Street. Why, it was odds on I'd be shot on sight, or cut down on the spot, before I could utter a word in my own defence. I didn't faint at the thought, but only the knowledge that I must act at once enabled me to fight down my mounting panic. Should I raise the alarm? God, no, I daren't, for if Franz Joseph was already a goner, I'd be cooked. The only hope was that Willem hadn't done for him yet, and that I could still, and that was when my legs almost gave way and I found myself fairly sobbing with fear, for I knew I must go out into the ghastly dark and find the murderous bastard and kill or disable him. Why, even if Franz Joseph was already tuning up with the choir invisible, I might wriggle clear if I could show that I'd flown to the rescue. Too late, alas. Oh, Jesus, they'd never believe me. I'm innocent, gentlemen, I swear it. I was bleating it softly in the darkness, and time was racing by, and I'd nothing but an empty pistol. But suppose Willem was still picking the lock, or waiting for moonset, or for his Holnup confederates to arrive, or pausing to relieve himself, or have a smoke, or for any other reason you like, and I could just steel myself to sally forth and find him, whispering raucously to identify myself. Well, he might wonder what the blazes I was about, but he'd not shoot before asking questions. And I still had the seaman's knife I'd slipped into my boot on the Orient Express, and he'd be off guard, just as his father had been when I'd parted his hair with the cherry brandy bottle. He might even turn his back on me. Well, it was that or the hangman's rope, unless they still went in for beheading in Austria. On that happy thought, I put up my empty piece, transferred the knife from my boot to my pocket, and crept as fast as might be down the stairs with my heart against my back teeth. There was the window, pale in the gloom. I slipped over the sill to the ground, and realized I'd no notion where the sundial corner was. I forced myself to envisage the house from above. There was the Emperor's room. Here was I, on t'other side. and there the guard-room by the front porch, so I must make my way cautiously by the back. There was still faint moonlight, casting shadows from the trees and bushes, and the loom of the house just visible to guide me as I crept along, my fingers brushing the ivy. In my imagination, the undergrowth was full of mad Hungarians waiting to leap out and knife me, and once I rose like a startled grouse as an owl hooted only a few yards away. Round one corner, peering cautiously, along the wall towards another, and there was something glittering in the dark off to one side, and I saw that it was the moonlight on a little puddle of rainwater that had collected on what might well be the surface of a sundial. And in that moment, from just beyond the corner I was approaching, came a sound that sent shivers down my spine, a faint clicking noise of metal, and the rustle of someone moving. I tried to whisper and failed, gulped, and tried again.
"Willem, are you there? It's me, Harry."
Dead silence, save for the pounding of my heart, and then the faintest of sounds, a foot scraping the ground, and after what seemed an age, Willem's whisper.
"What is das? Harry, is that you?"
It was still outside. Relief flooded through me, to be followed by a drench of fear at the thought of what I must do. I drew the knife from my pocket, holding it against my thigh, and edged my way round the corner. The ivy was thick on the wall just there, but there was light enough to see a dark opening a couple of yards ahead, the recess of the secret doorway, and just within it the pale outline of a face. I took another step, and the face hissed at me.
"What the hell are you doing here?"
In his agitation he lapsed into German.
"Stimmt etwas nicht? What's up, man?"
Where the inspiration came from, God knows.
"The Emperor ain't in bed,"
I whispered hoarsely.
He got up, his aides made a din and woke him.
Arschloch!
Whether he meant me or Franz Joseph, I can't say, but it was enough to assure me I was right. He was bent on murder. For if he'd been the innocent guardian, why the deuce should he care whether the Emperor was abed or not? The clicking I'd heard must have been his working on the lock. Gad, if he decided to give up for the night, I might not have to risk attacking him. I could pour out my tale to the Emperor in the morning, denouncing Willem, clearing myself. A whirlwind of wild hopes, you see, as I crouched peering at the dim face a yard away, near soiling myself in agitation. And then those hopes were dashed as he spoke again, soft and steady.
"Back inside with you. He's bound to go back to bed presently. And they may still come. Go on, man. Be off, quickly."
"And leave you to unpick the lock and do your business," thinks I. There's only one thing for it. I gripped the hilt hard, stepping closer. And as he opened his mouth to speak again, I struck upwards, going for his throat. He ducked like lightning. The blade drove past, missing by an inch. His hand clamped on my wrist, and as he twisted and I strove to wrench free, clawing fingers came out of the darkness on my right, fumbling for my throat. A fist smashed against my left temple, and I was hurled backwards and flung to the turf, pinned helpless by a massive body, while another seized my legs, and a great stinking paw closed on my mouth. They must have been there, unseen in the gloom, his Holnup accomplices springing into action with the speed and silence of expert bravos. I struggled like bedamned, expecting to feel the agonizing bite of steel, but it didn't come. The hands on my mouth and throat tightened, and I felt rather than saw a bearded face snarling into mine, in what may have been Hungarian. Above us in the dark, voices were whispering urgently. Willem seemed to be giving orders, and for an instant the hand lifted from my mouth, but before I could find the breath to bellow, a cloth was thrust between my teeth, and I was heaved over onto my face and my wrists pinioned behind me. Meanwhile, the debate overhead was deteriorating into agitated bickering, and since some of it was in German and my mind was most wonderfully concentrated, I gathered that Willem didn't know why I'd attacked him and didn't care, but if the Emperor was up and about, they'd best ignore the secret stair and invade the house in force. "No, no," says another, "the Englander's lying, they always do. And storming the house was too haphazard, and the aroused guard-room would be too many for them." To which a third voice said, "The hell, with such timidity, their lives would be well lost if they could only settle Franz Joseph." There's always one like that, you know, full of patriotic lunacy, and good luck to him. The heavyweight atop of me weighed in with a sensible suggestion that since subduing me had caused enough row to wake the dead, they should give over and come back tomorrow. But before this could be put to the vote, he was proved right by a challenge from the darkness, a bawled order, the pounding of boots, and a stentorian command to stand in the name of the Emperor. Willem exclaimed, "Missed!" His webley cracked, there was a yell of pain, and then bedlam ensued, with shots and oaths and screams. The dark was split by flashes of fire. I heard a clash of steel. My incubus arose, bawling in several languages and blazing away, and I hastened to improve my position by scrambling up, inadvertently butting him in the crotch. He fell away, howling, and I managed to gain my feet, and would have been going like a stag for the safety of the shrubbery, if he hadn't staggered into me, bewailing his damaged courting tackle. And I fell full length, only to rise again on stepping stones of my terrified self, but not, alas, to higher things, for something caught me an excruciating clout on the back of the skull, and the din of shots and shouting faded as I fell again, this time into merciful unconsciousness. I suppose I've been laid out, and come to, with a head throbbing like an engine room, more often than most fellows, and can testify that while one descent into oblivion is much like another, there are two kinds of awakening. After a dizzy moment in which you recall your last conscious memory, and wonder where the devil you are, realization dawns, and it may be blissful, as at Jalalabad, or in the cave in the Bighorn Mountains, when I knew that the hell and horror were behind me, and it was bedtime and all well. Or you may come round hanging by the heels from a cottonwood, with the Apache ladies' sewing circle preparing to tickle your fancy, or strapped over a cannon muzzle with the gunners blowing on their fuses. Having known the last two, I can tell you that waking to find yourself bound hand and foot on a camp bed underground, while alarming, ain't too bad by comparison. And when your smiling captor inquires after your health and offers refreshment, well, hope springs eternal, you know. For Willem von Starnberg was bending over me, all solicitude and sounding absolutely light-hearted. The governor was right. Never forget that fellows like Flashman always come at you when least expected, usually from behind. Should have paid more attention to the old chap, shouldn't I? He put a hand behind my head, and I yelped hoarsely. Split in to beat the band, eh? No wonder. Zoltan fetched you a deuce of a clip. You've been limp as a dead fish for eyes. Care for some schnapps?
Where the hell am I? What's happened?
My voice came out in a quavering croak as he removed the flask from my lips, and as I struggled into a sitting position with his help, my questions trailed off in amazement as I took in my surroundings. We were alone, in an enormous cavern of what looked like limestone, grey stone at any rate, but with an odd sheen to its towering walls. We were at one end, close by the black mouth of a tunnel, from which ran wooden rails bearing a couple of ancient wheeled bogey trucks. The rails ran for about 30 yards into the cave, to what looked like a cleft in the floor, and there must have been a bridge once, for I could see that the rails continued on the other side of the cleft, before being lost in the gloom. The place was like some cathedral made by nature, huge and empty and utterly silent. And staring up, I saw that high overhead there was a fissure in the roof, fringed by a tangle of growth from the world outside. And this was the only source of light, glistening dimly on those gigantic, smooth, curving walls. The floor of the cavern was smooth, too, and innocent of loose rocks or rubble, as though some giant housekeeper had swept the great chamber clean. But the wonder of the place, that made me catch my breath, even in my groggy condition, was the little lake that covered almost half the cavern floor, on the far side away from the rails. Very well, 'twas only water, a natural bath in the stone, but never was water so still, or clear, or silent. The surface was like glass, extending perhaps 30 yards in length by 20 across to the far wall. And in its crystal depths, undisturbed by current or eddy, you could make out every detail of the stone bottom 10 feet down, as though no water had been there at all. No fish could have swum in it, or weeds grown. It was immaculate, like some enchanted mirror of fairy tale, an ice witch's mirror in the heart of a magic mountain.
Only by the tunnel mouth where I lay were the signs of human occupation, a rough stone fireplace and utensils, palliasses and camp beds, plain chairs and table, a couple of packing cases and a litter of stores and gear. But like ourselves, these worldly things seemed out of place and dwarfed in the awful majesty of the cavern. The cold was fit to freeze you to the bone. "You're in an old salt mine in the South Camogut, in the mountains above Ischl," says Willem. "Jolly little tomb, ain't it? Hark away." He'd raised his voice, and the echo came back in an eerie whisper. "Hark away, away, away," fading ever so softly in the unseen reaches of the cavern. He stood, cocking an appreciative ear, very trim in riding boots, breeches, and shooting jacket, and none the worse, it seemed, for the free-for-all shooting match, which was the last thing I remembered. "We're near the surface here," says he, "but God knows how far the tunnels go below. The place hasn't been worked for years. Do you know, when I was a nipper, I pictured salt mines as hellish places, where slaves with red-rimmed eyes waded knee-deep in the stuff. But it's rather grand and spooky, don't you think? Splendid bolt-hole, too, for clandestine plotters like the Holnup. My lads were camped here for a week, but I've had to send them off now, thanks to you." He perched on a packing case, cradling his knee, and gave me his quizzy look. "When did you twig I was the fox at the hen roost, then?"
"Cut me loose first," croaks I.
But he only grinned and repeated the question. So I told him about finding the tampered cartridges, and he swore and slapped his thigh, laughing. "I'll be damned. That's what comes of being too clever by half. Oh, and being in awe of your fearsome reputation. Ironic, ain't it? I gave you a harmless pistol by way of insurance. But if I'd given you a loaded one, Franz Joseph would have been with his fathers by now. Or if you'd come on the scene a minute later, even. Oh, aye, we had the lock picked. I was about to go aloft when you arrived with your little snickers snee, curse you. And then that damned sergeant and his sentries. And we had to shoot our way clear, and lost two good men. One of them your pal Gunther. You'll be desolated to learn. Ah, well, c'est la guerre." You'd have thought he was describing a rag in the dormitory, chuckling with hardly a sign of irritation. Oh, he was Rudy's boy, all right, cool as a trout, and regarding me with amusement. "So there it is," cries he. "Franz Josef lives on. Two of my boys don't. There ain't a hope of a return match with half a regiment round the place by now, I imagine. Supposing F.J. hasn't decamped for Vienna already. The conspiracy is kaput. I've had to disperse the best band of night runners I ever hoped to see, and 4 weeks of damn good planning have gone down the bogs." He jumped down from his seat and stood before me, hands on hips. "Yes, sir, the governor was right. You truly are an inconvenient son of a bitch. Still, no hard feelings, what? Not on my side, leastways."
"Call me a skeptic if you will, but I doubted it. I'd come within a whisker of cutting his throat. Ruined his plot all unwitting, and cost him two men dead. And he didn't mind a bit. No, this could only be cat and mouse in the best Starnberg tradition, and his claws would show presently. In the meantime, with my innards turning cartwheels, I pretended to take him at face value. 'Glad to hear it,' says I. 'Then you won't mind cutting these infernal ropes?'
'Certainly, by and by,' says he, 'when my arrangements for departure are complete. Austria's a trifle warm just now, you see, what with two dead desperadoes under the Emperor's window, a sentry with a slit weasand, and those two mysterious visitors, Flashman and Starnberg, vanished none knows whither. It wouldn't surprise me,' says the sardonic pup, 'if they started looking for us, which is why I intend to be over the Italian border by daybreak tomorrow. I've no inclination to grace an Austrian gallows, or rot in a Brandenburg fortress, which is what'll happen if Bismarck ever learns the truth of our little soiree yestreen. He'd have my bollocks for breakfast.'
That settled one thing. So last night was off your own bat. Bismarck had nothing to do with it."
He stared. "With our gallant attempt to snuff Franz Josef's wick, you mean? Good Lord, no. My word, you do have a low opinion of our worthy Chancellor." He grinned at my bewilderment. "I see I'll have to explain. 2 months ago, the Holnup learned that F.J. was coming to Ischl without his usual retinue, and would be a sit-in bird for assassination. Plans were laid for a night attack on the lodge, But Bismarck got wind of it from a spy in the Holnup Council, and devised his great plan for guarding the Emperor, just as Kraltra and I told you. What he didn't know, when he entrusted it to me, his loyal agent, he went on, looking waggish, was that I happened to be a great nephew of Lajos Kossuth himself, and have been a member of the Holnup since boyhood, and that in choosing me to guard the great booby, he was playing into our hands, making our task even easier by handing me on a plate the golden opportunity that every Hungarian patriot has been praying for this 10 years past. You may be sure, he added, that we've identified the spy in our council, and have left him strictly alone for the time being. He paused, and just for a moment the bantering manner dropped from him like a cloak. The boyish face was set, and his eyes were far away as he said softly, "And we were so close. Another moment, another few seconds, and the blow would have been struck that would have freed Hungary from the Habsburgs forever. Holnup, Holnuputan." He gave a deep sigh, and slowly unclenched his hands. And then he was himself again, shaking his head at me in mock reproach. "You really have been an uncommon nuisance, you know."
For some reason, despite my fears, this infuriated me. "Because I stopped you from committing murder? Why, you damn fool, I saved your lousy life, more like. Bismarck would have had more than your bollocks, he'd have had your neck."
He regarded me pityingly. "Oh, ye of little faith, do you think I'm a half-wit? It was all arranged. Once F.J. had kicked the bucket, we'd have fetched you out of the house, quiet-like, tapped you gently on your great fat head, laid you up beside the royal corpse with a bloody knife in your hand, and left you to explain matters when you woke up." He regarded my expression of stupefied horror with cheerful satisfaction. "Of course they'd have hanged you, if they hadn't finished you off on the spot. But don't you see, I could then have pleaded injured innocence to Bismarck, pointing out that it wasn't I who brought you into the business, and that you must have gone berserk, or been a Holnup hireling all unsuspected, or killed F.J. for love of the beauteous Sissy, or anything at all. He'd have swallowed it. Besides, that would have been the least of his troubles, with the dogs of war slipping all over the parish, and everyone blaming perfidious Albion, as usual, and Gladstone having apoplexy."
He shrugged.
"I me, the best laid schemes.
What was the phrase young Hawkins used in his book? Surely, while you're above ground, hell wants its master. Spoken of the fictitious image of Rudy von Starnberg, but by God it fitted his abominable son even better, sitting there while he lighted another of his blasted cigarettes. Was he mad, perhaps? And why had he brought me to this ghastly solitude? It made no sense, for if he'd wanted me dead, they could have done for me in the fight at the lodge. Was it possible that his geniality was genuine, and that he didn't mean me harm after all? No, for why was I bound hand and foot? The evil bastard had brought me here to gloat, and he must have read my thoughts, for—" "So what now, you wonder?" says he.
"Well, Harry, that's a hard one, damned hard. You see, the fact is that I like you, and none the less because you balked me altogether. Indeed, all the more. And it's just a lost trick in the game, anyway. I'll settle Franz Josef one way or t'other, and before long, too. You may count on that. And then 'twill all come right, and Hungary will be free soil. But that's by the way."
He seated himself on his packing case again, blowing smoke rings, and watching them hang motionless in that windless cavern while my skin crawled.
"The hard thing, though, is that while you're a man after my own heart, just as you were after the governor's, and I'd like to clap hands and part friends,"
and damned if he didn't sound as though he meant it,
"you know too much, you see. At the moment, what happened last night is all a great mystery, officially. What do they know, Franz Josef's people? That someone was trying to do him in? The unlocked door and dead sentry tell him that. And that it was a Holnup job. The other dead and we had to leave with Gunther was a Magyar and a notorious firebrand. And that you and I were in the business somewhere or other. What then? Whatever they suspect, they can't prove a blessed thing against you and me, unless we're fool enough to let ourselves be collared in the next day or two, while the trail's hot and they're still full of zeal. After that, they'd be quite thankful to forget about us, and they can keep the whole unfortunate business quiet. See?"
I saw all right, and was struck by the sinister significance of the words, "You know too much." He continued, "Which is why I shall lay low in Italy for a spell before presenting myself to Bismarck, who'll have no earthly reason to suspect me. Au contraire, he'll welcome me with open arms. On the face of it, his great scheme will have worked to admiration, don't you see?" He sat forward, eyes shining. "The Holnup struck, failed, and left two of their number stark and stiff. Bravo, Sternberg, and flashy," cries Otto. "Couldn't have done better myself. That's what he's bound to think, and I shan't disillusion him. If he wonders why we didn't stay to take the credit, I'll say it seemed best to fade modestly away. Oh, he'll swallow it. But," he shook his head solemnly, "suppose you were to tell the true story of what happened last night, eh? I'd be embarrassed, Harry. Embarrassed to death, like as not."
"But I wouldn't say a word."
It came out in a bellow that made the echo ring.
"Never, I swear it. My God, no, I wouldn't dream of it. Why the hell should I want to? You can't believe that I'd ever—"
"So you say in the Salzkammer, Gert," he interrupted. "But safe in London or Paris? Who knows? Very well, you might keep mum, but I'm certain sure you won't if the Austrian Polizei nab you before you can get out of the country. And you haven't a hope of doing that."
"Why not? If you're making for Italy, we can—"
"I can, but you can't. I've a horse up top sides, and I know the country. But I can't risk a passenger. Sorry, Olden," says he, all manly regret, the hypocritical hound. "But I must take the high road, while you take the low."
This book is continued on Disc 6.